Author and scholar Sally Rush Wagner has died. She was 82. We'll hear her voice and remember her legacy. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, June 17th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a conversation from 2019 with Sally Rush Wagner. She was a towering figure in women's history studies, instrumental in honoring and restoring the legacy of American suffragist Matilda Joslyn Gage. She was the founding director of the Matilda Joslyn Gage Foundation and Social Justice Dialogue Center. Rush Wagner returned often to South Dakota and found inspiration in the landscape of the state, particularly near her roots in Aberdeen. I sat down with her in 2019 for the conversation you'll hear this hour, but she also joined me throughout the final years of her life with insight into the lessons of history for women today. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Author and scholar Sally Rush Wagner has passed away. Known for her work in reclaiming women's voices in history, Rush Wagner passionately uncovered and cemented the legacy of American suffragist Matilda Joslyn Gage. She was awarded one of the first doctorates in women's studies. She founded the first college-level women's studies program in the U.S. She was featured on the PBS program American Experience, and she often returned home to South Dakota to visit family and friends, to reconnect with the land, and to join me on In the Moment. She was originally from Aberdeen. Well, this hour, we would like to bring you a conversation from 2019. Sally Rush Wagner joined me in SDPB's Leo P. Flynn Gallery in Sioux Falls to discuss her book, The Women's Suffrage Movement. Welcome, Sally Rush Wagner. Thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate it. Thanks, Lori.
It's my pleasure.
Before we talk about the book, I want to talk about you a little bit because you're home in South Dakota and you grew up in Aberdeen. Is that right?
I did. And if people ask me, where do you live? I say New York. If they ask me, where are you from? I say South Dakota.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is it like to come home and watch over the years to come home and watch South Dakota change? How have you noticed it, even the landscape, changing?
I come back every summer to Pickerel Lake, where I've been coming since I was 5 years old. The answer that comes immediately is a really sad one, is the ecological change in the lake has been really distressing and sad to me. Mm. There are no bloodsuckers. We always went down to the water with a salt shaker because we knew we would get bloodsuckers on us from the docks. They're gone. The crayfish are gone. The fish that we knew are not there in the abundance they were, if they're there at all. Mm. And, the ecology of the lake is changed in ways. There's work now to restore it, and that's the heartening part. But it's the good changes that have happened. I just had some time to go around Sioux Falls, and the way that the old buildings are being brought back to life is wonderful, and the creative things that are being done. One of the best scones I've ever had in my life this morning. So, yeah, it's a mixed bag.
You wrote on Facebook just about driving.
Yes.
And it was such a beautiful, poetic, and evocative description of what it even means. Being from here, in some way, do you feel like you have a responsibility, an opportunity to tell other people what here is like?
Mm. You just outed me, maybe. I've written so much about South Dakota, files on my computer that someday may take form in some way. When I enter the prairies, I can breathe again. There's something about being enclosed in mountains, hills, and trees that it creates a degree of claustrophobia in me. And where I live is where I need to be doing the work that I'm doing. But when I come home every summer, it's to restore my soul. And I breathe differently here because my body remembers, I think, that first breath when, and the first view when you can see all the way to the end of the world. And that's South Dakota for me.
When you look back now at your childhood, whether it's time in the library or time in nature or whatever, are there things that you think sort of uniquely prepared you to do the work that you do in the world because you're from here?
Wow, you ask great questions. They're ones that I'll be pondering for years. a wonderful interview is a great gift, and thank you. Yeah, if I had not grown up in South Dakota, I would write differently. I would see the world differently. There's a place of silence that grows out of the land and the distance and the... I listen differently here because the cacophony of a closed space causes me to listen shallowly. But the distance in the prairies is a ponderous silence. And when I write here, when I'm here to write, and this is my writing time, especially, is when I'm here during the summer. And I think about it as I write from every part of me when I'm here.
Were you growing up a library kid? Were you? Did you spend some library time?
You know what? I did. And one of the things that I remember doing is that the Alexander Mitchell Library was needing repair, or we needed a new library. And it was, I think the roof was leaking and books were getting wet. And I remember somehow doing a commercial that was, I pretended to weep because the books that I loved to read were getting wet and no longer able to be read. So I suppose one of my first acts of activism was saving the books in the library. Would have been in grade school.
You in grade school. Yeah, it's not hard to pretend that you're weeping over the loss of the book. Yeah.
Well, I think I was prepped, you know, this is what you need to do.
Yeah, really. Turn it up, be really sad.
Yeah.
So you enter this educational landscape and you're one of the first people who's really pushing this idea of women's studies and women's history as an academic discipline. What is that like for you? How did you have people who were leading you in that direction? Was that something that you said, this is worthy of academic study, when others hadn't found it to be so? Tell us a little bit about that time.
You know, I'll tell you a memory from childhood that probably, you know, relates to your last question on this. I remember answering the phone as a child. And there was this weird sound at the other end. It was like, it was the raspberry. I had no idea what it was. Yeah. And I think I turned the phone over. You know, you had one phone then. And
right.
I turned it over to probably my mom. What is this? My mother was working with a group of women to expose the fact that there was mishandling of funds in the school system, and she was getting hate calls, and it was sort of, well, some people do silly things like that, you know, and it was sort of you need to do what you need to do to make the world a better place. And yeah, if you get raspberry phone calls, that's part of the game. So I think that I, you know, there was a kind of a fearlessness that comes from this area, that you just do what needs to be done and you move forward. And so when I was in college at California State University, Sacramento, moved there right after graduation, went to school there, we had a women's liberation group. And as we were doing this consciousness raising group, you know, and just sitting around, and it wasn't just a ain't it awful session, it was what are we going to do about it? And so we realized, many of us were students, and we realized that we weren't even represented in our classes. Mm-hmm. We didn't exist. You know, there were no women who had done anything. It was all male. Our professors were almost all males. And that was what, around the country and the world, you know, started that revolution in the academy. It was part of the women's liberation movement. And so we demanded a women's studies program. And we actually founded, I taught my first class in 1970. And we formed what was the first university or college women's studies program to offer a minor in women's studies. Yeah.
And did you know it was the first?
Yes. Yeah, that we I had to check my memory with that. But we actually, there was a commemoration a few years ago, and the library checked and the special collections doing the research and found that we had the very first.
So you had the idea that there were these untold stories. Mm-hmm. You were not under the illusion that women hadn't done these remarkable mm-hmm. things. Finding the untold stories is a hallmark of your career. It's still important to you today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why is it so important?
Uh-oh, we got to repopulate history, you know? Mary Baird said, that is what we need to be about the business. And it's not just repopulating with individual women. It's that the world doesn't change with individuals. Abraham Lincoln didn't end slavery. It was the push of the abolitionists that pushed him to that position. Mm-hmm. Movements are what changes the world. Individuals can inspire and spark movements, but it's movements that transform society. Mm-hmm. And so these untold stories are stories of you know, individual women, but they're women within a context. There are women who are working together. I didn't establish the first women's studies program in the country to offer a minor. I was part of a movement that did that. Mm. On my own? Nah.
Were there people trying to block that? What sorts of things that today people would say, they didn't say that to you? Like, what sorts of things were they saying?
I'll give you an example. Yeah. When we attempted to get the marital rape law changed in the state of California, every state in the union had rape laws that read something like this: rape is an act of unlawful sexual intercourse with someone other than the wife of the perpetrator. Marriage was a way to avoid rape charges, essentially. Every husband had the right to his wife's body. They raised this issue in the 19th century. It's in my anthology. Women raised this issue over 100 years ago. And so in California, we were trying to get this law changed to create a marital rape law to make it illegal for a husband to rape. One of the lawmakers, one of the senators on the floor of the California Senate said, "Oh, come on, guys. If you can't rape your wife, who can you rape?" And everyone laughed. Hmm. That's the world we lived in. I can't begin to tell you every step. Mansplaining, I mean, it was, we didn't have a word for it, but boy, did we experience it. Yeah. It was, well, I agree with you girls, but you're going about it the wrong way. What you ought to do is, I could keep you here, Lori, for days.
What sustained you? You, plural. What sustained this group of women having in your circle, mm-hmm. having these conversations when you hear something like that and you realize, you already know, but you realize that this is a joke, that this is how it's seen. I mean, how do you not get defeated by that in some ways? What sustained you as a group?
Because you have the group. Mm. Yeah. I think if you get sectioned off, if you get separated out, it's very hard to sustain. But when you have that group spirit and that group support, and you know that you're bringing history forward, you're on the right side of history. It's discouraging. I mean, it's hard. But you do it. And the other thing is that I think that courage is in some ways an overrated virtue, that it becomes a way of life, you know? It becomes it has an energy of its own, that when you overcome something, when you, you know, when you push the limits of your own comfort, it becomes a perk, you know? I mean, maybe it's physiologically addictive, you know? Maybe I'm just addicted to adrenaline, I don't know. And you sleep well at night.
For folks who have not experienced this notion of these women and the influence of the indigenous women of this continent, explain why it was important for you mm-hmm. to take a fresh look at that influence.
Well, I think... I like to think of the book as exploding some fake feminism, fake feminist history, that the timeline of the women's suffrage movement that I learned, and actually my students at Syracuse University come into class having learned the same timeline today, is that it begins in 1848 with the Seneca Falls Convention, and it goes in a straight line working for the vote, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, until 1920 when they finally win. Yeah. Every piece of that is wrong.
Let's start with that first
and
piece.
And let's start
it
with
doesn't
the 1848.
Begin in yeah.
Okay, we'll
it,
begin
yeah.
at the beginning. Haudenosaunee, or Iroquois, as the French called them, women have had political voice on this land for at least 1,000 years. And they may not be the only indigenous women. They're the ones that I pointed to in the anthology because they are the ones that inspired the women suffrage leaders. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Matilda Joslyn Gage, Lucretia Mott, and others. These are women who, for 1,000 years, have had the responsibility of nominating, raising up the boys that they see have the qualities of a good chief or sachem. And they nominate, it's everybody has a voice. Even if a child were to say, this man did something inappropriate to me, he would never be considered as a chief. There are three rules. He cannot have committed a murder, he cannot have committed a theft, and he cannot have abused a woman. I remember the first time that a Klan mother told me that, and I thought it was the Iran-Contra hearings were going on television in the next room. And I remember thinking, wow, who would be left in Washington if those were our rules?
Right.
You know? And so she nominates him. She holds him in his position, which is that he needs to listen to the women and to the community through her. And then he and the men, you know, are the decision-making process. But it's not the sort of, you know, pyramid thing that we have where the epitome is at the top. It's really the people, it's a pure democracy, and the people really are ruling. And if he does something that does not represent the interests of the people, she gives him a warning. She gives him a second warning. And if he doesn't listen to her and the others that go with her to warn him that he needs to change his ways and to help him to think through doing it a different way, she has the responsibility to remove him. Elizabeth Cady Stanton called it cutting off his horns. And I remember when one of the Klan mothers and I spoke at an Elizabeth Cady Stanton birthday tea a number of years ago. And, you know, I gave this, she, you know, she'll cut off his horns, and the feminist audience went wild. and I talked about the right that she had to do this. Then my friend, the Klan mother, got up and said, you know, I have these responsibilities. I name the children. I name the chief, and I have the responsibility to remove him if necessary. I have never seen that. It would be the saddest thing I could ever imagine, because we would be so out of balance. And as we were talking later, I said, you know, I talk about rights, and you talk about responsibilities. And we were trying to figure out what that language difference was. And what we came up with was that rights are what you talk about in the absence of them, and responsibilities are what you have when you have a balance of authority. Mm-hmm. And power is not even the correct term, because in our, you know, patriarchal system, power is always over. And power with is a concept that we're just beginning to develop. So power is not a word that is appropriate in this situation.
What is the potential influence of bringing this part of the narrative back, bringing this truth back into mm-hmm. how we understand this story? What can happen when a book like this says, wait, what you thought mm-hmm. is not complete?
Well, it begins to break down that white supremacist idea that history begins when white people land. And it also, I think, allows us to listen to voices that, it invites us to listen to voices that, for me at least, are wiser than I am. You know, when you have people who have a history of living in harmony, not just with each other, but with nature, who sustain this land for, you know, thousands of years, and what we've done as the white settlers in 500 years to destroy the ecology of this land, not just South Dakota, but, you know, all of Turtle Island. You know, it invites us to listen to voices of women who have, they know how to work this. They know how to do it. They've been doing it for 1,000 years. You know, it's like we're the infants who could learn from the elders. And they're the elders who, despite all the efforts to totally colonize and totally force them into, you know, it was kill the Indian, Christianize, civilize them. Mm-hmm. Despite all those efforts, they have maintained amazingly, and there's a resurgence of it here, all around the nations, the native nations.
At the time of contact, mm-hmm. as things and colonization spreads, mm-hmm. these people have an understanding of what they're losing from a political power, what we would call political power. Is there a sense of knowledge of this is the influence that women in particular, mm-hmm. tribal women, indigenous women have? Yeah. They see it slipping away. They worry about it.
Let me give you an example from the book. We go to 1888 and the International Council of Women, the first time that women from throughout the Western world are meeting in the United States to talk about their condition. An anthropologist, early anthropologist, Alice Fletcher, tells this story about being with women from the Omaha Nation. She said she was staying with them, and one of the women gave away a horse. And she said, without thinking, I said, hadn't you better check with your husband first? And she said, the merriment with which my, you know, it's like, what planet is this woman from? She said, for a minute, I forgot that I wasn't with white women who, when you married, every bit of your property became your husband's. You know, everything you earned, anything that you had, became your husband's to do whatever he wanted to with it. And so the thought of a woman actually, you know, giving away something without checking first was just... Then she goes on to say that she said, I have met with Native men, with Indian men, and one of them that she cites, I was able to track down, and I'm almost certain it was Sitting Bull, who said, you know, we're worried about what's happening to us when we come under United States law, but we're more worried about what's going to happen to the women, because they will lose their position, not just as Indians, but as women. One of the examples she points out is that if a man violated a woman, and this is all, you know, in 19th century language, but if a man violated a woman, her clansmen, her Taoiseach, the men would take care of the offending person, the offending man. And she said, under United States law, the perpetrator, if he was the husband, would go unpunished if he beat his wife, if he, you know, sexually violated her. He would go unpunished under United States law, but who would get punished? The men of her Taiosh Paye, who took care of the offender. You know, it's like the world turned upside down. And she's giving this example to international feminists during the time. Yeah, they knew. The white women knew and the Native women knew. They knew what was happening and what was going on and resisted in whatever ways they were able to. And amazingly have maintained the essence of their world. Mm.
One of the things that I find, and we're talking with Sally Rush Wagner now, and her latest book is called The Women's Suffrage Movement. One of the things I found revealing and eye-opening and at times shocking was some of the things that these women were talking about openly. They're talking about sex trafficking. They're talking about the rape of slaves. They're talking about abortion. They're talking about birth control.
Yeah.
Did you have that same moment where you thought that this is language? I mean, they're using a different language, but boy, they're not mincing words.
No, they are
with
not.
What they are talking about. They're not just talking about a vote.
No, no. It's way beyond the vote. And that's the lie of it was only the vote.
Right.
You know, if we think about, let's take equal pay. Equal pay for equal work. That was old adage by 1850. Women were making half the wages men were making then. Now, 150 years later, we're making a little over 75%. You know, you ask kids, so do the math. When are we going to have pay equity in the United States? Well, you know, the math is 150 years. The answer is we are going to decide that based on our activism.
Yeah.
But when you have that historical perspective, it looks different. Here's another example. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Joslyn Gage, the two major thinkers, the two major theoreticians, the two, I think, leading intellectuals of the women's rights movement, both believed in the sanctity of the right of the unborn. And you know what that meant to them? The greatest right is to be chosen and wanted. And so they said, Matilda Joslyn Gage said, for a woman to birth an unwanted child is a crime against the mother and a sin against the soul of the child. Every child born has the sacred right to be chosen and wanted and brought into the world with love and joy.
Were women left out of political power intentionally? Or is this sort of notion of, you know, remember the ladies, like, was it just kind of get forgotten? Was it a political compromise? Was it an intentional effort?
It was intentional. When Abigail Adams, you know, during the revolutionary period, says to John, look, you know, if you don't pay attention to women, we're going to foment a rebellion. And what she meant was, England had just adopted a very restrictive, the Blackstone Code. And what it meant was that when, under the law, when a woman married, she became dead in the law. She ceased to exist legally. It's based on canon law, the two shall become one and the one is the man. Woman shall be obedient to the husband, you know, from Genesis, the story of Eve, all the way to St. Paul. That becomes the basis historically for common law. And that then gets tightened right before the revolution in our country, in England. And she's saying to John, don't adopt the Blackstone Code. Well, guess what they do? Women voted in the colonies if they had property. Property was the qualification. Under the new state constitutions after the revolution, every state said it was illegal for women to vote. Took women out of voting and you know, adopted all those laws that said, you know, right to property. Women had no right to, here's the extreme of it. Women did not have the right to their own children. A husband could will away an unborn child, and on his deathbed, you know, he knows he's dying, and he decides he wants this child to be raised by someone other than the mother. He can name someone else as the guardian. And the mother gives birth, he dies, the mother gives birth, and that child is taken away from her and given to its rightful owner. That's how, and you had no right to your body. Husband could beat his wife as long as he didn't inflict permanent damage. It was a way of maintaining obedience.
I want to make sure we get to this idea of how the vote was won. Before, you have said, before we can celebrate in 2020, we need accountability for some of the policies that incorporated white supremacy intentionally. Walk us through that.
Okay, I'm going to start with the 1830s. First, female anti-slavery society formed by African-American women grows, white and black women together. 1837, they have their first national convention. They are, as you mentioned, talking about the institutional rape, the institutionalized rape of enslaved women. It's institutionalized in the system. And these are women who have worked together. They have a long history, you know, a decade before, almost two decades before the first local women's rights convention in Seneca Falls and the first national in 1850. So these are African American and white women who have a long working relationship. They've petitioned, they've faced down mobs, they know how to organize, they know how to fundraise, they know how to, you know, they know what a movement's about. The Civil War happens, and the slavery constitution, you know, the constitution had slavery built into it. Three-fifths of a person is how you determine representation. You know, how many representatives are you going to have based on population? How are you going to figure out how you count enslaved people? Well, we'll do three-fifths of a person. So it's built into the Constitution. You end slavery with the 13th Amendment, and now you have to change the, you know, you have to change the Constitution, and you have to determine who's citizens. So are these freed people, are they citizens and can they vote? 15th Amendment says African-American men can vote. This is a moment when the anti-slavery movement, the women's movement come together, form a new organization to fight for universal suffrage. but Congress, which is, and the radical Republicans are in charge of Congress, but they get cold feet. And they say, nope, we can only do African-American men right now. And this throws women under the bus, and even worse, the 14th Amendment, which is the enabling legislation, saying the federal government has the responsibility to protect the vote for African-American men. It's like, well, how are we going to define citizens in here? We're going to have to put male in because it's only male citizens who can vote. So for the first time, the Constitution has gender introduced into it. You know, before then, it's gender neutral. Doesn't recognize citizenship could be everybody, and it's assumed it is. Now it's only males. So what happens is that there's a split in the movement over, you know, look, we don't like what's going on. There's some real racism that goes on with especially Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony in this moment. They take funding because they can't get it from the other, from the movement itself, won't give it to them. They make a partnership with a racist, George Francis Train, who funds their newspaper, and their newspaper, The Revolution, is full of racist rhetoric. That is not policy of the movement. That's individual racism. It has consequences for sure. But what happens is that there's two organizations that come out of this split, the National and the American. The National is Stanton, Anthony, Gage, most of the old pioneers. The American is Lucy Stone, Henry Blackwell, Mary Livermore, you know, a different Boston group. These two groups work differently. The National works for the vote through a federal amendment. The American works for the vote through states only, okay? Now think about it. What's the implication of this? If states can give women the vote, can't states take the vote away from African-American men? You know, if you give states that authority, all of a sudden the federal government with the 14th, 15th Amendment is saying federal government can determine who can vote. It's taking it away from the states. It's that's never been real clear to that point. But now all of a sudden the federal government says, no, we have the authority, and we have the authority to enforce that. American takes the states' rights position. Jump 20 years, and Susan B. Anthony has a single vision, and that's the vote. If we get the vote, we can take care of everything else. So she works with Lucy Stone and Lucy's daughter, Alice Stone Blackwell, and they put together a merger plan. And this is where dirty politics come in, and I don't want anybody to accept this on my word, but read the document right. That's in the anthology that will make you plug your nose. Mm-hmm. Susan B. Anthony is doing dirty politics that's worthy of any dirty politician today. And she affects this merger, which is really a takeover by the American, the states' rights group, the more conservative group. Then we get to the last 30 years. 1890 to 1920, and what the National American, this new merged group, comes up with is give women the vote because white women outnumber Negroes and immigrants, and women's suffrage is a way to maintain white native-born supremacy. That is the language of the National American. That is their policy. And because they practice states' rights, the states can do whatever they want, the state organizations. So the state organizations in the South are able to and do, in cases, segregate, won't allow African-American women to be part of the organization. They work for the vote for white women only, and they work for the strengthening of voter suppression, the Jim Crow laws. The accountability, I think, is this. We won the battle and lost the war for freedom. Because if you think about the strength and the strengthening of voter suppression laws today, where would we be if the woman suffrage movement, instead of making an alliance with white racists, male white racists and female white racists in the South, if they had instead made an alliance with the African American men who could vote and the immigrant men who could vote. In South Dakota, Carrie Chapman Catt was furious because these ignorant immigrants got the vote, were able to vote, and white, you know, cultured, refined, educated white women weren't. That was the language. Elizabeth Cady Stanton's final speech, the last speech of her life at a convention, is a call for educated suffrage, which was, you know, a buzzword for if people have been denied the right to learn to read and write as enslaved people had, and you call for educated suffrage, you're saying basically only white people should vote. And immigrants, before they learn the language, or while they're learning it, if you call for educated suffrage, you know.
For people who have said, well, that's just, those are the compromise. I mean, well, we want to plug our nose, but put yourself back in that time and see how those compromises were made. Yep. You're saying, what if we had made better coalition, different coalitions?
Exactly.
What if, what if?
The National American was asked to work against the discrimination in transportation. They refused. They were directly asked in a convention, and they refused. They were asked to work against lynching, and they didn't. How many lives of African American men might have been saved if the organized women's movement would have fought with Ida B. Wells to end lynching? You know, where would we be today? I mean, we look at the African American women that are emerging now as leaders and as voices. Where would we be today if their voices and their political expertise would have been with us for this whole long time, 100 years at least? African American women, some are saying, we're not going to celebrate this. We didn't get the vote until 1965 with the Voter Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the end of the poll tax in 66. Native Americans, it's a complicated issue as I understand it, because those who are maintaining their sovereign nationhood are not voting in United States elections. There are others who do dual citizenship and they are voting, and now we have two Native women, you know, in Congress. But Native Americans didn't have the right to choose whether or not they would vote until 1924. And still, the voter suppression went on and maybe still goes on today, huh? Mm-hmm. In some of these states that we are in or very close to.
I want to close our time together with this notion of what comes next. Where do we stand today? And one of the topics I'm hoping you can address is this idea of women behaving badly. In this book, you see they're protesting at the Statue of Liberty. Mm-hmm. They're burning the president in effigy. Mm-hmm. They're doing things that seem very un-American, very, deplorable. Mm-hmm. Today, what is the lesson from history for women who want to enact change today?
I think a movement is an ecological balance, and there are those working on the outside and those working on the inside. If the National Woman's Party hadn't emerged pushing for the federal amendment and taking that strong action, saying to the President of the United States, you are sending our boys to be killed in Europe, fighting for democracy while you're denying it to the women at home. You know, they chained themselves to the White House. They burned the president in effigy. They were force-fed in prison when they went, you know, on hunger strikes. Tubes put through their noses, and you know, they experienced atrocities in the prison system, and exposed the prison system at the same time. But if they hadn't taken that advance stand, it made, you know, it was sort of like, well, listen to us, the National American, Carrie Chapman Catt says, you know, because we're the reasonable ones, the ones willing to work for you, not those crazy women out there. Change happens because there are those crazy women out there who are, you know, they, in 1876, they, Matilda Joslyn Gage and Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote a Declaration of Rights of Women, since the original one didn't include us, apparently. And they, Susan B. Anthony and Matilda Joslyn Gage, presented it illegally at the official celebration, knowing they would probably be arrested. And Gage wrote, "We didn't do this for the women of our time. We did this for the daughters of 1976, so they would know that their mothers of 1876 had impeached the government for its treatment of women." These were kick-ass women. And if we don't have kick-ass women, we don't get change.
Author Sally Rush Wagner, recorded in our SDPB studios in 2019, Sally Rush Wagner passed away on June 11th. You can find and share this full conversation, as well as several other In the Moment interviews, including an interview with Sally Rush Wagner and Gloria Steinem. Find those on our website, sdpb.org. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.